11:33 a.m., your cell phone blares with an emergency alert of an incident at the Pickering Nuclear Generating Station. And in your suddenly adrenal state, you think, Pickering? Nuclear? What are they talking about? And then you learn...
The Pickering Nuclear Station has 8 reactors. It's one of the world's oldest nuclear stations, and it's also one of the largest. It's also been deemed the least reliable and the most expensive. And guess what? It's surrounded by 2.2 million people within 30 kilometers. That's twice as many as the Indian Point Nuclear Station, which is outside of New York City. It is in the middle of the Greater Toronto Area.
Well, even if you manage to read far enough into the alert to see that it says that there is no danger, which means there's no reason for an alert, except they sent the alert, so maybe there is a reason for it, it still brings into clear focus the fact that even in your cozy bed at 7:33 on a Sunday morning, you are still in that uncomfortable, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we jump in on this week's story of the false warning of a radiation accident at the 8-reactor Pickering Nuclear Power Station in Ontario, Canada. We talk with Angela Bischoff of the Ontario Clean Air Alliance, who not only gives us that story, but several others related to the nuclear situation in Canada, including the still active plans to possibly site a nuclear waste repository only 1 mile from the shore of Lake Huron. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest information than we've seen at the Oscars since Dr. Strangelove. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, January 14, 2020, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting off in the U.S., where the Department of Energy's semi-autonomous National Nuclear Security Administration has formally announced that it is proceeding with aggressive plans to expand the production of plutonium pits without required nationwide programmatic public review. A coalition of watchdog groups, including the Natural Resources Defense Council, Nuclear Watch New Mexico, Savannah Riverside Watch, and Tri-Valley Cares, assert that this is in direct violation of the legal requirements of both the National Environmental Policy Act and the 1998 court order that stipulates that Department of Energy must prepare, quote, a programmatic environmental impact statement when it plans to produce more than 80 pits per year. Plutonium pits are the radioactive cores or triggers of nuclear weapons, so each one represents another nuke. Jay Coughlin of Nuclear Watch New Mexico concluded, "We need to find smart ways to face the world's renewed nuclear arms race. Unnecessary expanded production of questionable plutonium bomb cores is not the way to do it. Instead of aggressively modifying nuclear weapons, the U.S. should carefully preserve its existing, reliable, extensively tested nuclear weapons stockpile while working towards a future world free of them." Several U.S. stories, too complex to go into here, but we're going to have links up on the website. This first one is a new article, "Unmanaged Climate Risks to Spent Fuel from U.S. Nuclear Power Plants, the Case of Sea Level Rise."
One of the authors of this is Robert Alvarez, a regular source on Nuclear Hot Seat. He's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies and served as senior policy advisor to the Energy Department's secretary and deputy assistant secretary for national security and the environment from 1993 to 1999. That's actually a scientific paper, Unmanaged Climate Risks to Spent Fuel from U.S. Nuclear Power Plants, The Case of Sea Level Rise. A Colorado professor is warning the world of nuclear winter again. This is about the work of Brian Toon. He is a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And nuclear winter is one of those aspects of nuclear war that somehow never gets mentioned by the powers that be. Well, he talks about it, and we're going to have more coming up this year on Nuclear Hot Seat. The article, 170 million Americans are drinking radioactive water. This interactive map shows if you are too. We'll, of course, link to both the article and the map. Much of this is based on the work that was done at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln several years ago about where uranium is showing up in the drinking water around the United States. And some good news out of Maryland. Montgomery County has joined Baltimore and Washington, D.C. with Back from the Brink, a resolution that supports the United Nations Nuclear Ban Treaty, alongside the U.S. Conference of Mayors and 40 municipalities and state legislators from California to Maine. This comes from an op-ed in the Baltimore Sun, and it's well worth your time to read it. Over to Japan, where during recent maintenance work at the Ikata nuclear power plant, a control rod was removed from the reactor by mistake. This according to owner Shikoku Electric Power Company. Control rods are used to suppress nuclear fission and are inserted in order to halt a nuclear reactor. One of the 48 control rods in the unit was lifted out of the reactor containment vessel accidentally at around 1:20 p.m. on Sunday, January 12, and was not replaced until around 7 hours later. That's when it was reinserted into the reactor. According to a tweet sent out by Arne Gunderson, chief engineer at Fairwinds Energy Education, Homer Simpson must be working at the Ikata nuclear plant. How can you mistakenly remove a control rod that is responsible for stopping a nuclear chain reaction? I don't know, Arne. Beats me. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, numbnuts of the week.
The always reliable source for numbnuts, the 2020 Tokyo Olympic Games, has announced that it plans to use flowers produced in Fukushima, Miyagi, and Iwate prefectures, those areas that they will admit were hit by the 2011 earthquake and tsunami, while not mentioning the nuclear radiation release from Fukushima Daiichi. Those flowers are going to be used in victory bouquets awarded to Olympic and Paralympic medalists. Around 5,000 bouquets are being prepared for the games and will contain prairie gentians from Fukushima. The Abukuma Cut Flower Group, which was behind the growing of these flowers before the 2011 nuclear triple meltdown, again started cultivating these flowers in 2014 before the evacuation order was lifted. And there's no word if there is any testing going on for radiation in the flowers, or in the soil, or in the water, or in the air. And what about all of those athletes who get this beautiful bouquet and then keep it forever dried and displayed prominently where, if it has radioactive materials in it, it will continue to irradiate the immediate presence for a half-life of who knows what? And that's why, once again, 2020 Radioactive Tokyo Olympics, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
I think the ongoing and ever-growing numbnutsery of the 2020 Radioactive Tokyo Olympics deserves its own feature, don't you? We're working on it. In Australia, citizens are becoming more concerned about the issue of transporting nuclear waste across the country in the age of brush fires. The U.S. National Academies Press compiled a lengthy and comprehensive report on risks of transporting nuclear waste and concluded that among other various risks, the most serious and significant is fire. Now, with brush fires raging across much of New South Wales, including the Lucas Heights area where there is a nuclear reactor, as well as north and coastal East Victoria and South Australia, if nuclear waste were to be transported across the continent, whether by land or sea, they'd be traveling through much of this area. And if they were attempted today, they'd be confronting very long-duration, fully engulfing fires. As to the routes and methods of transport that the waste might take, the Australian Nuclear Science and Technology Organization said that it will not comment on the port, routes, or timing until after transport is complete. Huge potential risks there. Huge. In Uganda, as of September of 2019, that country signed an intergovernmental agreement with Russia to build capacity to exploit nuclear technology, they are saying, for energy, medical, and other quote-unquote peaceful purposes. The Uganda government has already identified 5 potential sites for such nuclear reactors, each of them being in close proximity to a large body of water. In New Zealand, veterans who were deployed to the Mururoa Atoll will wait another 2 months to find out whether their children and grandchildren may be genetically impacted by nuclear radiation. Mururoa was the site of French nuclear weapons tests from the 1960s through the 1990s. A Mururoa nuclear veterans group teamed up with Otago University last year to produce a study about whether the families of veterans deployed to Mururoa Atoll in 1973 may have been affected by their parents' exposure to radiation. About 145 people participated in the study, which took 6 weeks. It is now being peer-reviewed for the New Zealand Medical Journal. A new United States law requires a probe of the Marshall Islands nuclear dump that's been threatened by rising seas. Congress is demanding that the Department of Energy investigate an aging, cracking U.S. nuclear waste dump threatened by climate change and rising seas in the Marshall Islands. This is part of the new National Defense Authorization Act signed in late December by President Donald Trump. According to the law, the energy agency must submit a report that includes an assessment of how rising sea levels might affect the dome. Many Marshallese argue that the United States has not done enough to address its history of radioactive contamination in the islands or help the nation deal with the growing assaults of climate change. The Philippine Department of Agriculture has removed the radiation analysis requirement on selected Japanese commodities for import into that country. Fish, beef, apples, and pears from Japan will no longer be subject to radiation testing. And the UK government has let its residents know that in case of imminent nuclear war, they'll receive a text message, just like the people in Ontario did earlier this week. It's the same system being used by the U.S. government in case of imminent nuclear attack. Oh, I feel ever so reassured. Not. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, the pro-nuclear propaganda just keeps coming, thick and fast, setting up talking points that the casual reader or legislator or listener will catch in headlines and absorb as gospel truth, when it's really just the opposite. What is there to counter the lies of the nuclear industry? All the money and influence and smug, smarmy talking points? As you might suspect, I'm talking about this show, Nuclear Hot Seat. Now in its 9th year, Nuclear Hot Seat has been one of the only places where you can consistently get a 1-hour hit of honest nuclear information. We do this every week. Interviews with genuine experts, a roundup of international news with never enough time to give all the stories the time they deserve, numbnuts of the week, bad puns, sometimes a little bit of musical theater. Where else can you find all this in a weekly counterbalance to the nuclear industry lies? Of course, Nuclear Hot Seat has been operating for years on a budget that's less than what one nuclear lobbyist gets for 1 week of lunches with powerful legislators. And that budget is dependent on you, the listeners, to keep us going. So if you oppose nuclear and want to help get the word out, help us do so by sending us a donation. We make it easy for you to do. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button to send a one-time donation or set up a monthly donation of any size. And to send us a monthly $5, this is for the budget conscious who still want to make your presence known. Just click on the big green donate button at nuclearhotseat.com. Please do what you can now. And know that whatever you do to help, you're keeping this show running, for which I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Here's this week's featured interview. As you heard earlier in this show, Ontario in Canada got a real wake-up call on Sunday, January 12, when a warning of an incident at the 8-reactor Pickering nuclear facility was sent out to their cell phones at 7:33 in the morning and wasn't rescinded until 9:11 a.m. So what was that like? And what has been the fallout from that nuclear fail? To find out, I spoke with Angela Bischoff. She is director of the Ontario Clean Air Alliance. They're the ones behind Ontario's coal phase-out. And the group has since turned its attention towards moving Ontario to a 100% renewable future by investing in conservation, made in Ontario green energy, and water power imports from Quebec, while phasing out Ontario's 18, count them, 18, high-cost, risky nuclear reactors. Angela Bischoff and I talked just this morning, January 14, 2020. Angela Bischoff, you are up in Ontario, so you are on the front lines of what has been happening up there. Fill us in. Since Sunday the 12th and that false warning that went out, if indeed it was a false warning, what have you found out? What's been happening?
It is incredible. Well, just a little bit of background for your listeners. The Pickering Nuclear Station has 8 reactors. 2 were shut down for safety reasons. But it's one of the world's oldest nuclear stations in the world. And it's also one of the largest. It's also been deemed the least reliable and the most expensive. All of those things. And guess what? It's surrounded by 2.2 million people within 30 kilometers. That's twice as many as the Indian Point nuclear station, which is outside of New York City. It is in the middle of the Greater Toronto Area, the GTA. It's smack dab in the middle of millions of people. And it was supposed to last, it was designed to last 30 years. It's now 49. It keeps getting license extensions. It's got another license extension to run until 2024, at which point the station will be 54 years old. And just today, the premier of the province announced that they have no intention of closing it in 2024.
Oh, no.
That just happened today. That was a bomb dropped on us today. But the bomb dropped on us on Sunday. It was at 7:30 in the morning. Thousands of residents all around Ontario, not just around the nuclear station, though it was supposed to be specified, got a notice on their cell phones waking them up at 7:30 in the morning to tell them there'd been an incident at the Pickering nuclear station. To stay in place, there hadn't been an irregular release of radioactivity. Stay tuned for more information. So everybody was freaking out. Our website was down, crashed, because everybody was trying to get on it. And an hour and a half later, at 9:11 a.m. on Sunday morning, they sent out a second text message to all of those same people saying, oops, false alarm.
You know, this has echoes of so many things and so much comes to mind. Especially the fact that their immediate response is, oh, you know, there's been no radiation release. We're just warning you about the fact that there might be a danger. And did they say anything about having to stay inside or stay away from windows? Okay, because at Three Mile Island, that's what we got coming down the middle of the street. Stay away from your doors and windows and don't go outside unless you absolutely have to, like that. So people just got a warning of, oops, something happened, but hey, no radiation, but we are giving this to you on our emergency response network. Be calm, is basically what they were saying simultaneously. Would that be a good summation of it?
Yeah. So it turned out it was just like some sort of a drill exercise they were doing and someone pressed the wrong button. That's what they're claiming. It's hard to believe, but maybe, like, the station has been running as usual. The reactors are producing power into the grid as usual. So they haven't shut anything down. So maybe it just was, a false alarm. In which case, it woke people up to the dangers of having an 8-reactor nuclear station in the middle of millions of people. So suddenly people are super concerned. And then 2 days later, the premier, who is kind of the Donald Trump of Ontario, announces, oh, forget about the false alarm. We're actually extending the length of that, one of the world's oldest nuclear stations, in the middle of millions of people. It's just insane. So I've just spent the last 3 days responding to people's concerns and sending out my own alerts and, you know, dealing on social media and sending out bulletins to our subscribers to say, like, we have lower cost renewable options to meeting our electricity needs. We do not need to even keep this nuclear station open, which the citizens subsidize massively because it's such a high cost, inefficient nuclear station. We could replace it with a combination of water power from Quebec, conservation, made in Ontario, green energy. But what is this? This premier is actually, the first thing he did when he got elected a year and a half ago was cancel 758 renewable energy contracts that had already been signed by the previous government and were in some stage of proceeding. Two of the projects were already complete. They were worth hundreds of million dollars each. The turbines were up in the air already, and they canceled the midstream, and the turbines are being ripped down. It's tragic. Meanwhile, we're doubling down on rebuilding the aging Darlington nuclear station with its 4 reactors, also in the Greater Toronto Area, and rebuilding 8 reactors at the Bruce nuclear station, which is where they want to bury all the low and intermediate level waste that a lot of Americans have been fighting because it's right on the shores of Lake Huron. They want to rebuild that station as well, 12 reactors. It's unprecedented. No other country is rebuilding reactors, locking us into high-cost nuclear power for another 5 decades. When we have lower-cost renewable options available to us, it's complete insanity.
I think one of the things that people don't understand about why after 30 years, or here in the United States, after 40 years, nuclear reactors were planned to be shut down. And that's because of the issue of embrittlement, which is that because in the containment structure, it's being bombarded with nuclear particles constantly, the containment, the steel, the materials that are in there progressively degrade, they corrode. And when they were originally built, the engineer said, look, these things are only going to be good for, in the case of Canada, 30 years, in the case of the United States, 40 years, and at that point shut down. Well, in the U.S. across the board, there have been 20-year renewals going up to 60 years, and now Turkey Point down in Florida just got an extension to go to 80 years, and that's the beginning of the culmination of a campaign that was started back when I first got started with Nuclear Hot Seat in 2011. They started a campaign called, very cutely, Is There Life After 60? And they were talking about nuclear reactors, and they put their lobbyists and their PR people and their propaganda and their millions upon millions of dollars to work. And lo and behold, now we're getting stuck with these things that are going to be going twice as long as the original engineers said that they were supposed to be shut down. So when we talk about the need to shut down these older nuclear reactors, it's not just, they're old, we don't like them, we want something else now. It's that there is a real danger, and the danger is that they could break down and release enormous amounts of radioactivity, and then people have to understand what radioactivity does to the body to understand exactly why these things are putting the future of life on Earth on the line.
I look forward to your book on radioactivity. I'm the first one to order a whole bunch of those and give them all to my friends and read it myself.
Thank you. I've been working on an accessible, understandable way of explaining radiation to people so that it's not jargoned up, because any radioactivity that people are exposed to is cumulative. It hits the body. It stays in the body. And if it's external, it you know, there might be some protections against it. But once it gets inside you, then it's up close and personal with your organs, with your body on the inside. And you can get it through breathing it. You can get it through drinking water that has it in, because our groundwater is incredibly compromised. Or eating food that has been watered or been sprinkled with this. It's in the land. It's in the water. It comes up in the food. We eat the food. The food's inside of us. And then we're being irradiated from the inside out. And that's a topic for a lot more conversation. But right now, I'm interested in a year ago. And interestingly, it's almost a year ago to the day. It was January 13 of last year that the Hawaii nuclear false alert happened, where they suddenly got the tweets and the texts on their phones saying, incoming missile, take protective measures immediately. This is not a drill. And there's video all over YouTube, especially in one case, a college campus, with the kids running and screaming, trying to find a basement to hide in, because only some of them knew that was a possibility. So here we are a year later with another one. In addition to people crashing your website and being in contact with you, what has been the response? What did people do immediately during that hour and a half when they didn't know? And what have they been doing since that time?
Well, we do know that 32,000 people ordered their potassium iodide pills, which are available free from the province. So they got flooded with orders. So people were very concerned, but the text actually said, do not leave, you know, just wait for more information. So I don't know if the highways got filled with people. The media hasn't reported that.
How has the media reporting gone on this? Have they been covering it at all?
Yes, incredibly. I get Google alerts, and yeah, there's been dozens of articles every day I've done for media interviews myself, and they've been all over this. But again, they're not super critical. They've been interviewing us to get the critical voice, but basically it's kind of government response.
What would be a way to build upon this incident in terms of not only people's awareness, but people's opposition to and harnessing some of the energy while it is fresh and provoked and out there?
Well, yesterday we sent out a bulletin to our supporters and bought Facebook ads and, you know, tweeted, etc. And today we sent out a new one because there was new information about the extension of the life of the plant. So we're just putting the word out, sending media, the media are all on our list as well. So we're just trying to keep it alive by giving it a good critical response with links. You know, the whole, our bulletins and media releases are completely hyperlinked with a million different references on the dangers of Pickering, the history of its accidents and safety concerns, links to the design flaws of the station. For example, any of the American reactors at stations, each of the reactors has its own containment system so that if there's a leak of some sort, it can contain it within that one reactor. But Pickering shares one containment system. So if there's one leak in one of the reactors, there can be a cascading effect and they can all explode. So, I mean, that's a safety flaw, right? That's a pretty obvious safety flaw. And it wouldn't even get permission to be built with that safety flaw anymore.
With all of the things you're sending out, I have to go very techno geek on this one. Do you have a consistent hashtag that you are using so that people can search you and find you in all of your complexity?
No. We used to have Close Pickering for a long time, and then we lost the campaign to Close Pickering in 2018. And then, you know, the campaign extended, and suddenly we were acceptant of the fact that they got regulatory approval to run until 2024. So then we started focusing on decommissioning the Pickering nuclear station immediately after 2024, which OPG, or the owner of the plant, Ontario Power Generation, wants to keep the station running for 30 years after shutdown. In the States, when you've had four or five reactors completely decommissioned immediately after shutdown. We, however, with our CANDU reactors, our Crown Corporation, wants to let them sit idle for 30 years before decommissioning. So we're advocating that we do immediate decommissioning, as is recommended by the IAEA as best practice. So that's one. Another one is hashtag Buy Quebec Power. We've been focusing on replacing our aging nuclear infrastructure with water power from Quebec. They have a massive surplus. They don't have a market for it because they have been unable to build transmission lines to the New England states because of environmental opposition. So they're sitting on this massive surplus of water power. We could be buying it at a third the cost of rebuilding our aging nukes. We've got the transmission lines already. Why would any government choose to rebuild our aging nukes when we could replace them with water power from Quebec at one-third the price, saving billions of dollars? It makes absolutely no sense. But we've been advocating for that for years, Buy Quebec Power.
To be cynical about this, which I think is being accurate about it as well, follow the money. Follow who's getting the money, who's getting rich off of this. And people who think that they have enough money or they're making enough money off of this, that they will be immune to the consequences of their actions, which indeed is not the case, because nobody's immune to what's happening. This is global. Anything that happens nuclear gets released to the environment. It's stuck here on Earth. It's not going anywhere. So inevitably, what goes around comes around, quite literally, and they will be hit with it as well. Yet, I think that it's the short-term, short-sighted looking of people who do not have any concern about people or the environment, which is the byline that the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission likes to take, that we protect people and the environment. Oh, there are more lies in that little statement than can be counted. But that what needs to be done is somehow raise people's awareness about what the dangers are. So let's do a little brainstorming here. What do you think people need to know, and how quickly and simply and elegantly can we state it so that they get the fact that they are putting not only their own lives right now, but really the future of everything on the line with this technology?
For the most part, people are unaware that they even have 18 nuclear reactors in Ontario pumping out the majority of our electricity. We're the second most nuclearized jurisdiction in the world. And people are completely unaware that we have 12 nuclear reactors in the Greater Toronto Area. Nobody knows that. And those who do, like, they might know we have some stations, or they might have heard of Pickering, for example, they believe they're safe. And that's the meme that just gets repeated over and over and over. And it's because the media repeated over and over and over. It's because the nuclear industry gives millions of dollars to the newspapers and to the radio stations and to the baseball conglomerates. And everywhere you go, you just see this, you're bombarded with this propaganda that nuclear power is safe and nuclear power is cheap. So that's all they hear. And so we're, you know, there's a couple of small underfunded community groups that are trying to get the word out of the dangers and the past incidents that have happened at the Pickering nuclear station, and the potential for, like, massive catastrophic accident. And look what happened at Fukushima and Chernobyl. So we're doing our best, but we're up against the machine, which is pumping out a steady flow of propaganda that the station is not only clean and safe and low cost, but emission free. People are just, this is how we're going to meet our climate targets. People, so those are just the regular memes I'm getting fed every day.
I saw a particularly good meme come out of, I think it was out of Saskatchewan. It showed two footprints, and it said, do not trade a carbon footprint for a radiation footprint or a nuclear footprint. And there was a lot of wording around it that made it very specific to that campaign. But I think that just that visual alone and the ability to reuse it no matter where we are in the world would be a good point to make. because branding nuclear as some kind of clean green savior to climate change is one of the greatest hoaxes, I think, that has been perpetrated on the planet, and much to our detriment, as you and I and everyone I interview on this show all know. We can survive. We can turn around carbon without going to radiation, because for however long carbon lasts, the radioactivity lasts for millions, if not billions, of years. And that's actually the subject of the other interview that I have for today's show, if it ends up being today's show as opposed to two separate ones. And that's with Carl Grossman talking about how the entire planet has to be made a nuclear-free zone, meaning not only nuclear weapons, but also nuclear reactors, because nuclear reactors are the source of the plutonium, the man-made plutonium materials that can then be transformed into bombs. And any country that's got a reactor, in essence, has the raw materials for a bomb.
Excellent. I can't wait to hear that.
We've been going far afield here, but there are a lot of issues in Canada, and our two countries are butt up against each other. So what affects one affects the other. Where does it stand now in terms of the creation of the nuclear waste dumps?
Most people are a little confused over this. There are several proposals for various waste dumps around the province, but the two that are most relevant to your question, one is for the low and intermediate level waste, and that's the one that they're proposing to build at the Bruce Nuclear Station on the shore of Lake Huron. And that would be a DGR, a deep geologic repository, 680 meters below the surface of the earth, which is basically under Lake Huron. So when it eventually leaks, it'll go right into the lake. But that's for what they call low and intermediate level waste. At present, a whole bunch of that low level waste is being incinerated at the station to just blow into the air. But the high level nuclear waste, the fuel waste, that is presently on the site of all the nuclear stations in the country. They have been looking for a site also for a DGR around the country. They started with 26 sites. They're down to two. One is in northern Ontario, and the other is not at the Bruce Station, but in the county, like essentially right beside the Bruce Station. And so, you know, most of us are a little bit like, oh, sure, they're going to build one repository for all the low and intermediate, and then they're going to build another one a mile away for all the high-level waste. I doubt it. You know how expensive, they were talking billions of dollars to build these repositories. We expect that they're going to want to merge the two together and put the high-level waste also on the Bruce nuclear site on the shore of Lake Huron.
Which, of course, is being opposed not only by municipalities surrounding the Great Lakes in Canada, but also in the United States. There was an extensive campaign that was done in various communities to write opposition to this, and there are well over 100 that is being coordinated to great extent through NEIS, Nuclear Energy and Information Service, in Chicago. That's where they're based. So there are many campaigns against it. So what can people do? Those of us here in the United States, I have listeners literally around the world for Nuclear Hot Seat. What can we do to support you in Canada in turning this around?
Well, there is a petition that people can sign called sosgreatlakes.org/say no. SOS Great Lakes should get you to the petition. And there has been a lot of opposition built in Canada. Entire municipalities, hundreds of municipalities have said no to the dump on Lake Huron, including hundreds of municipalities in the United States. You can, it was coordinated by SOS Great Lakes, so you can see all the different municipalities that have signed on to that petition and on to the whole campaign to say no to Ontario Power Generation's plan to bury all of Ontario's low and intermediate level waste at the Bruce nuclear site on the shore of Lake Huron. That's what people can do to oppose that one. And we're just waiting word from the federal government for approval on that. And the federal government has also said that they want to get approval from the local First Nation there, the Saugeen Ojibwe First Nation, Saun. And this Saun has said that they will make a decision like this winter. We're expecting a decision from Saun any day. And OPG has offered Son millions and millions of dollars, now, essentially bribing them to accept it.
Now, when you say Son,
it's a First Nation, Saugeen Ojibwe First Nation. The Bruce Nuclear Station is on their territory. So they essentially have veto over the burial. It's a First Nation community, but it's a separate First Nation community that encompasses the Bruce Nuclear Station. And OPG has said they would give this First Nation community veto power over the project. And this First Nation is expected to make a decision on that anytime this winter.
Wow. I can't even imagine the kind of pressure, be it personal or verbal or monetary or who knows what other promises there might be, that are being slung around right now to try and get them to agree to this.
Now, ultimately, it is a federal decision, though. Like, even though it's OPG, the provincial Crown Corporation, that wants to bury the nuclear waste, the low and intermediate level nuclear waste on Lake Huron, the federal government will still have to sign off. But then the whole issue of the national NWMO, the Nuclear Waste Management Organization, they're looking for the site for all the high-level nuclear waste. And that one is a whole totally different story. And if they choose to also bury that at the Bruce Nuclear Station, or even if they choose the site, anyways, it's in the same neighborhood of the province as the Bruce Nuclear Station. Even if they built another one, a second repository for the high-level nuclear waste, it's going to be close to Lake Huron as well. And we haven't mounted a massive, like there's no petition, or we haven't, because they're still in the siting process, there has not been a campaign to oppose that, other than individual organizations participating.
Now, the organization that you are with, the Ontario Clean Air Alliance, regularly sends out a fantastic compilation of articles. I think it's every week, twice a month, something like that. And if people wish to be put on the mailing list to receive this information, how would they go about doing it?
They should sign up to our regular bulletin. And if you just go to cleanairalliance.org, at the bottom, you can sign up to the bulletin. But I also have a more activist newsletter called No Nukes News. And that comes out, you know, sort of every couple of weeks as well. If you go to the cleanairalliance.org website and under the button at the top, Get Involved, you can scroll down to No Nukes News and you can also subscribe to that newsletter, which is more activist-y and has sort of the best news and information. I often include your show on there of the most important news and information about nuclear news around the world. Whereas the Ontario Clean Air Alliance Bulletin is very focused on Ontario.
One thing I want to roll back to, and that is, after this warning came out, did you or did anyone from your organization do research into finding out whether there were spikes in radiation levels that were showing up anywhere in the area? And if so, what was or was not discovered?
So no, we haven't, because it's just not our strength. We work more on policy. But my understanding is that the provincial Ontario Power Generation doesn't have to release information on daily spikes. They only release like monthly summaries.
Oh, they've got this tricked out 12 ways to Sunday. And are there any independent monitoring groups or means of getting that information?
I don't know who's monitoring that, to be honest. I know it'll come out. It'll come back to us if there were spikes, because people are monitoring it.
Well, here's the offer. First of all, keep us informed here at Nuclear Hot Seat of anything that shows up, if there are spikes that show up, if there is other information that we need to know. Get it here. We will get it out. The other half is, Angela, I would like to make you a correspondent for Nuclear Hot Seat.
Nice. Canadian
correspondent. One of several. I'm lining up people to be correspondents from different communities.
Nice.
And
If and as there is any news from Canada that we need to know about, let us know. You'll be recorded. You'll be part of the show. How's that?
Excellent. Thanks, Libby. I love it. I love what you're doing. It's just brilliant that you've been able to keep it going for as long as you have. It's so great. Thank you.
And thank you, Angela, for the work that you're doing up there and for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
My pleasure.
Ours too, Angela. That was Angela Bischoff, who is director of the Ontario Clean Air Alliance and now Canadian correspondent for Nuclear Hot Seat. Activist shout outs! A heads up that the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists will host a live international news conference at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time on Thursday, January 23rd, to announce the 2020 time of the Doomsday Clock. This is the clock that shows us how close we are, in their estimation, to nuclear annihilation. Speakers for the Doomsday Clock announcement will be former governor of the state of California, Jerry Brown, Mary Robinson, chair of the Elders, and former president of Ireland, as well as former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, and Ban Ki-moon, deputy chair of the Elders, and former secretary general of the United Nations. Any bets by how much closer it's going to change? Right now it's at 2 minutes to midnight. But I'm willing to bet it's going to be 1 minute to midnight or even shorter than that. While you're waiting for a week from this Thursday to come around so you can learn that news, know that the Bulletin has also published a very important article, which is the 6 best nuclear risk stories of 2019. A good compendium for background on why that clock is undoubtedly going to move closer to midnight this year. There was a great podcast interview recorded between Bruce Gagnon of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space and Carl Grossman, who is both a full professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury and our eminence grise when it comes to knowing all things nuclear going back decades. We'll have a link up to that on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 447. And Carl Grossman is going to be our guest next week, talking about how Earth needs to be a nuclear-free zone, both weapons and reactors. And if you need a good example of why people need to know more about what radiation is and what it does and how little they understand, I turn your attention to this week's Antiques Roadshow. This was the episode with the Winterthur Museum, Gardens, and Library, Hour 1. At the segment at the end, the feedback booth, a woman showed a small figurine of an angel that her grandmother put in her bedroom to watch over her. It glowed in the dark. The woman brought this artifact of her childhood to the Antiques Roadshow, and lo and behold, it turns out to be radioactive. So what does the woman say during this feedback booth tiny segment? She's still holding on to the little figure, now looking at it a bit disconcerted, and says, I guess I'll use some hand sanitizer and then bring it home. Sanitizer's not going to do it. And you have an ongoing risk of radiation exposure. Low level, but low level over a long time is as dangerous, if not more dangerous, than a large dose in a short time. And who knows where that little angel has been? Did you keep it in your pocket? Was it on a stand next to your head? Has it been passed around? Hand sanitizer's not going to do it. So either find a way to store it safely in a lead container or contact your municipality's hazardous waste management center and find out the proper way of disposing of it. I don't care what memories it's got. If there are any weird health things going on with you or anyone else who's been exposed to this over long periods of time through the years, this might be the source. And if I were you, I would scrub not only your hands, but everything that thing has touched. People tend to think that they're safe from the effects of nuclear radiation, and let's just say, oh boy, none of us is. Here's today's final thought. and it comes off our featured story this week. I have come to understand that, as regards the public, the purpose of the nuclear establishment, be it government, the military, or the industry, their purpose is to manage panic in the populace should anything go wrong. Take last Sunday's text warning of a nuclear accident at the Pickering nuclear reactor site. In the initial warning, it contained the line, there has been no abnormal release of radiation, the no in capital letters. So they raised an emergency alert while at the same time telling us there was no emergency there. But how could they make that analysis so quickly? But then, nuclear rarely, if ever, makes sense. Then, there's the Hawaii incoming missile alert that happened almost exactly 2 years ago, on January 13, 2018, not 2019, as I referenced it in the interview. This one contained the words, "This is not a drill," in capital letters, when indeed, it was a drill. Panic ensued. But in the wake of that incident, the Hawaiian Islands' entrenched resistance to a nuclear missile defense ramp-up largely disappeared. So the panic, even if it was inadvertent and unplanned, was still terrifying and was still managed to be of use to the nuclear powers that be. As part of that management policy, any irregularity at a nuclear facility that becomes public knowledge is immediately dismissed as no danger. They used to say no immediate danger, using immediate as a semantic get-out-of-jail-free card, because radiation takes a while to show up in your body unless it's a catastrophic dose. That was a semantic point I hammered at regularly on this show, just about every week. And then suddenly, poof, the word disappeared from all nuclear discourse. I guess I should be flattered that they're listening. In any event, whenever anything goes wrong, they play the game of the demeaning, there, there, missy, don't worry your pretty little head about it. Mansplaining and gaslighting all of us until, in 3 to 5 years for thyroid nodules and cancers, 10, 20, 40 years or more for hard tumors and other diseases, we learn that there was a lot to be worried about. Just ask them in Rocky Flats, Colorado, North St. Louis, Piketon, Ohio, the Tularosa Basin in New Mexico, and so many other places. Now, I have twice experienced the panic of either being on the nuclear accident front lines or thinking I was. The first time, in 1959, I was living in Chicago when the White Sox won the American Baseball League pennant, and Mayor Daley, the first Mayor Daley, ordered air raid sirens set off as part of the victory celebration, something he failed to let anybody know about in advance. So when I heard them, I thought we were under attack by the Russians and didn't understand why my family was not running for the basement to hide from the nuclear bomb. We called it an atomic bomb in those days. That was another piece of rebranding. But they didn't want to run to the basement. They just wanted to sit there, watch TV, and laugh at me for being so upset. The second time, as I say on every show, was when I was staying with friends 1 mile from the nuclear reactor at Three Mile Island when that accident, the nuclear meltdown, happened. And let's stop calling it a partial meltdown. That's like saying it was partly pregnant. It was a meltdown. We listened to official reassurances and ignored the warnings of friends and families to get out. On the second day of the accident, I went walking around outside at the exact time that the radiation plume was being released, something that they didn't tell us about then and didn't admit to afterwards, and I didn't learn about until only 6 years ago, when I'd already been doing this show for over 2 years. In the first case, with the White Sox, I experienced full-on nuclear panic for no reason other than a politician's ego. But in the second, allowing my initial nuclear panic to be managed and manipulated by the vested interests that be led to years of health impacts I did not understand, as well as my decision not to have children. Be it managed or unmanaged, fear and panic are the logical responses to anything nuclear, especially when it goes awry. Our challenge, as an ever more aware public, is to take those instances of panic and use the energy that is released by it to fuel our pushback to the greedy, irresponsible weapons and power industry, they're one and the same, that has put us and the future of our planet at risk. The opposite of panic is focused anger at whatever was used to panic us, that it exists, that it is a runaway technology, and that the people who perpetrate its unending evils upon us think they are immune to the consequences of their actions, when they are most certainly not. And neither are we, none of us. So don't let yourself be managed or frightened out of a reasonable anger response to an unreasonable technology. Because if we don't fight back, the nuclear bad guys have won. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, January 14, 2020. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN, the bulletin.org, Nuclear Watch New Mexico, Tri-Valley Cares, Savannah River Site Watch, Natural Resources Defense Council, EINPressWire.com, CPR.org, WiseMindBody.com, Baltimore Sun, ScienceDirect.com, JapanTimes.co.jp, Mainichi.jp, Monitor.co.ug, BWorldOnline.com, LiveScience.com, Fizz.org, KnoxNews.com, InsiderFinancial.net, BusinessInsider.com, TheGuardian.com, APNews.com, Reuters.com, DailyStar.co.uk, and the terrific input and suggestions I get through email and Facebook messages from activists around the world. A reminder that Nuclear Hot Seat is available on all your favorite podcast platforms, so what are you waiting for? Subscribe so you get the show every week. And if you'd like an even easier way to get the show, go to our website, nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down to the yellow box, and put your first name in and your email address, and we will send you the link every week by email as soon as it posts. I want to thank all of you who are listening and joining Nuclear Hot Seat. We have listeners and followers around the world in 123 countries on 6 continents, and we also have a growing network of broadcast stations around the United States, especially community broadcast stations, that are carrying the show. Whatever you can do to share it, to post it, to make your local community radio stations aware of it, please do so, so we can continue growing our awareness and know the actions to take. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, like I said, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. It's a much better way to get information to me than that Facebook messaging. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment to go to our website, nuclearhotseat.com, where you'll see a red button and a green button that will allow you to support our work. And we will be greatly appreciative of all your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2020, Libby, Halevy, and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevy of Hartestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that as former U.S. President Ronald Reagan said, a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. There you go. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.